This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Nurse Casey Hickox has now faced down quarantines in two states. She was isolated against her will in New Jersey upon arrival from Sierra Leone, where she'd spent a month treating Ebola patients. After being released to her home state of Maine this week, Hickox openly defied a quarantine imposed by state authorities there. Hickox has tested negative for the virus and insists that she is no threat to public health. So far, one person in the U.S. has died of Ebola. Three people who contracted the disease have been released after being treated, and a New York doctor is currently in treatment. A number of reports and some health officials warn that hysteria over Ebola may be a much more dangerous epidemic. Marty Nemko is a writer and speaker and host for KALW Public Radio in San Francisco. He wrote an article for Time Magazine's Ideas section called The Absurd Cost of Overreaction. We spoke to him earlier this week. So we can guess from the title where you stand. What, to your mind, are some of the overreactive responses to the Ebola virus?
Well, almost all of it. There's only been one person who has died in America, and all the experts say that the probability of any kind of massive expansion of the disease in the United States is trivial, and yet we are spending literally billions of dollars on it for everything from screening every healthcare professional to having committee after committee decide how much screening should there be of passengers coming in from where. We don't think probabilistically.
Tell me about what you mean by probabilistically. This is something that also came up in a Psychology Today article you wrote about the response. What does that mean?
We tend to think viscerally. We tend to think, oh my God, it's a horrible disease. It's a very high fatality rate. So we've got to do everything we can to stop it, without asking ourselves, what is the cost benefit and the risk reward? For example, every time we expend a dollar or every time we expend an hour of our time, there is a cost, what we otherwise could be spending the dollar or the hour of time on. And so, for example, we've moved in this country to a major move toward bicycling, and there are tons of deaths and maimings as a result of bicycling, and almost no money is spent on trying to get the public to be more aware of bicyclists as we drive. We could, with far greater certitude, save more lives by focusing on that than the massive response we're having to Ebola. That's more probabilistic thinking. Where is the dollars and where is the time likely to make a bigger difference?
But this is a serious public health issue. I mean, we've watched on the news how it's devastated people in three countries, primarily in West Africa. So people are afraid. How do we get off of the fear, the panic button, and actually look more probabilistically, I'll use your term, at the science?
No. The probability is what it is. Here in America, is the probability high that we in America are going to get more benefit from spending millions and billions of dollars of money and time trying to stem the spread of Ebola here? The fact that it's in Guinea and West Africa has little relationship to that. We tend to viscerally say, oh my God, look what's going on there. And frankly, the media has been truly the perpetrator of this. It has fanned the flames of this rather than themselves thinking probabilistically.
Well, we do know some cases of severe overreaction to students who had moved from Rwanda to Burlington, New Jersey, were kept home from school. Now, Rwanda, no cases at all of Ebola, thousands of miles away. Parents pulled their kids out of a Mississippi school because of a concern that the principal had visited Zambia, 3,000 miles away from the affected West African countries. Now, Marty, you offer examples of how panic has guided U.S. response to previous events or tragedies at great cost. And what are some examples of those?
My favorite example, of course, is the shoe bomber. The shoe bomber put a plastic explosive in and tried to blow up a plane. Every terrorist knows that we now make every single human being take off their shoes. What are the odds that a terrorist was going to choose that as their modus operandi? And yet we continue to lose millions of minutes of passenger time and the indirect cost to society. People just are ever less likely to want to travel because of the ever greater incursions and the greater time it takes, all because of something that has a near zero probability of occurring.
Well, we're looking at the forcible quarantines under New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo of people who are returning from West Africa, in the case of Casey Hickox, a nurse who had served in Sierra Leone. But Andrew Cuomo, for his part, said, better safe than sorry. Now, would you want to be the person on whose watch a shoe bomber did decide to slip through and not take his shoes off? And I'm assuming it's a he. Would you want to be the governor of a state who let somebody who was infected with Ebola into the state?
That is really the word, better safe than sorry, is the most anti-intellectual, really, I hate to use the word, but stupid CYA approach to anything. If we are insisting on maximum safety, we should never leave our houses because we might get bitten by a rattlesnake if we leave. It is a CYA strategy.
Well, what does CYA mean, by the way? I don't know.
Cover your ass.
Oh.
Because, you know, no politician wants to appear to have done nothing. And for the one in a 10 million chance that somebody in Arkansas is going to get Ebola, we are willing to reallocate millions and billions of dollars, not billions in the case of Arkansas, but millions of dollars away from something that would more certainly do good. Because we're afraid, oh, better safe than sorry. We can't control all risk. We must probabilistically assess, where are our dollars and time best spent?
All right, let me get to the money for a second. The WHO has estimated that it will take nearly $1 billion required to fight Ebola globally. So far, the Obama administration has delivered and or committed about $750 million. But even if it doesn't ever reach U.S. shores, is it not worth dedicating that level of resources to help stop the disease in Guinea, in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, the three West African countries where thousands have died?
It's there we get into a gray area. What is the value of a human life? What is the opportunity cost? Right now, we have billions of kids in Africa who are not immunized against diseases we know that are curable. We're not spending the money on that. I'm not against, you know, that's a tough call. I do think the worldwide community, because the African infrastructure, health infrastructure is so paltry and the loss of human life is so great, then yes, can I argue against that? No, now we're in the gray areas. But to spend the hundreds of millions of dollars that we're spending here in this country to stop Ebola in this country, that seems clear.
Marty Nemko, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Marty Nemko, career coach, writer, speaker, and host of Working with Marty Nemko on KALW Public Radio in San Francisco. We do have a link to read his article in Time magazine called The Absurd Cost of Overreaction. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. While the U.S. grapples with panic over the very real and very deadly Ebola virus, Word of Mouth continues with a look at how one might respond to a completely fictional crisis. Up next, where would you go if a zombie apocalypse hit New Hampshire? We'll find out when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For those willing to risk the extreme weather, the summit of Mount Washington has much to offer, aside from the hiking and climbing. Visitors can catch a bite at the Tip Top House. You can tour the Mount Washington Observatory Museum, which is the state's most popular. And if the skies are clear, take in a spectacular view. There's one other possible perk that New England's highest peak is not known for. Producer Taylor Quimby reports.
In 1934, a weather observer stationed at the peak of Mount Washington recorded a then-record wind gust of 231 miles per hour. As a point of reference, that's in the same neighborhood as an F5 tornado. And yet, Mount Washington isn't just home of the world's worst weather, as a sign at the summit famously boasts. It's also home to a concrete weather station where a team of researchers live year-round. And if you ask me, it's the perfect place to survive the zombie apocalypse.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because when I first climbed right up this ridge, that was actually my very first thought when I got inside these walls. I was like, you know what? This would make an excellent zombie holdout.
Yeah. Was it really?
Yeah, I actually thought that. Yeah, it's
first thought.
You know?
It's a perfect fortress up here, you know? You got the one road coming up. Snipe the zombies if they're coming.
Yeah.
You get your supplies by the train here. Protect it very easily. You know, sit on top. I don't know. Like a video game.
What's your name?
Paul Molesky. Brother Paul Molesky.
There's nothing fun about imagining life, say, after a nuclear war, or fantasizing about how you'd survive a global pandemic. But there is something oddly intriguing about a zombie apocalypse.
You can talk about things like bottled water and stockpiling antibiotics and, oh, we need a radio. And if you know deep down in your heart that it's because of zombies, then you can still sleep at night.
It's fake, so it's safe. That's Max Brooks, by the way, author of World War Z and The Zombie Survival Guide. Now, I don't own a gas mask or keep a stockpile of canned tuna in my basement. In other words, I'm no prepper. But I really do enjoy a good zombie escape plan. Because you don't have to be an Olympic athlete or a trained Navy SEAL to survive a zombie apocalypse. Anybody with a good head on their shoulders has a fighting chance. It's all about good planning and making do with limited resources. But after visiting Mount Washington for the first time last September, I just couldn't stop thinking about it. I pictured striking out after the first zombies hit southern New Hampshire, guiding my family from our home in Concord towards my mom's place in North Conway. I'd be wearing somebody's discarded plaid jacket, sporting a rugged post-apocalyptic beard, and wielding a modified shovel as a combination walking stick and zombie basher. I pictured us arriving at the top, cold and weary, but safe. The closest thing to a happily ever after, given the circumstances, surviving indefinitely in our little castle, the Mount Washington Observatory. But how realistic is this fantasy? Aside from the Living Dead part, I mean, the general idea being that the mountain and the extreme weather would act as a natural defense against the zombies, it's everything else I wonder about. The survival part. So before I went back up the mountain to do an inventory, I called Max Brooks and asked him what to look for in a good zombie fort.
A source of water. That's the most important. If you don't have a source of water, you're dead in 3 days. Does it have the ability to dispose of your excrement? Because if you let that stuff pile up, you'll be just dead from disease. Is it far enough away from any thoroughfares? Because what you don't want is people deserting their cars on the freeway and blundering into your fort, or seeing it from the air and saying, oh, remember that observatory that we flew over on the mountaintop? Yeah, once we crash the plane in the lake, let's double back and find that.
Okay, let's start with water. Ryan Knapp, night meteorologist at the Mount Washington Observatory.
Yep, we have a well that goes several hundred feet down, about 600 to 800, I've heard from others. But fresh water gets pulled up from the Lake of the Clouds aquifer.
Water? Check. Now, I know what you're thinking. What if the station loses power? Won't the pump stop working? Back before a main line was installed, the station used to run on kerosene generators, and they're still there as a backup. Knapp says the enormous tanks that sit on a ridge just below the observatory still hold enough fuel to power the station for up to a year. Okay, next question. Where does the waste go? Bill Grenfell, director of museum operations.
Well, the summit is self-contained. All the waste, it flows downhill into a treatment plant that uses biological means to break down everything and filter it.
Waste? Check. Next question? Sleeping arrangements. A floor down from the research portion of the building are the living quarters, a comfortable set of rooms with a distinct college dorm feel, except for the bedrooms.
It's triple bunk beds, side by side, and they're pretty comfy.
That's Caitlin O'Brien, an education specialist at the observatory, or the OBS, as they call it. The OBS has 17 beds in total, plus a couple of couches. So plenty of room for me, my son, and my wife. But not my extended family. Next up, food.
That one on the left there has all of our frozen fruits and vegetables and things like that.
The pantry is stocked with giant cans of beans, huge slabs of frozen meat, jumbo boxes of cereal, you name it. Bulk food gets delivered every 2 months, and Caitlin guesses the staff could probably survive for about three once the deliveries stopped coming. Scott Henley, the observatory's executive director.
We have the communications infrastructure. We have the facility. We have the food. We don't have much in the way of artillery, except for some shovels.
Crowbars.
Yeah, we do have plenty of crowbars.
Those are actually good zombie weapons.
Oh, see? We're more prepared than we thought.
All in all, it's as comfortable a home as anybody could hope for at 6,228 feet above sea level. There's just one really big problem. Max Brooks.
Well, I think simply by doing this story, you've invalidated it.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, yeah, because the most important aspect of a zombie fortress is anonymity. See, the biggest problem in a zombie outbreak is not going to be zombies. It's going to be refugees. Because zombies are not a tenth as dangerous as a desperate Homo sapien.
Right.
And so you're going to be dealing with a lot of hungry, sick, scared, very desperate people who have heard this report and now know exactly how attractive the Mount Washington Observatory is.
The observatory is just too conspicuous. I mean, how many bumper stickers have you seen that say, "This car climbed Mount Washington"? More people visit the Observatory Museum than they do any other museum in New Hampshire, and it's only open 5 months out of the year. Not even the staff is totally convinced of the zombie plan. Here's Serena Bride, director of summit operations at the OBS.
If it were just me, I'd say yeah, but the more people I have with me, or the larger the group, or more people that I have to care for or support, the more that I'm going to question if it's the right move or not, just because it's such a difficult and treacherous environment.
When Max Brooks wrote World War Z, he accomplished a very, very improbable task. He managed to write a serious, literary zombie novel, one that transcends the silliness of the genre. And as I talked to people for this story, I learned to appreciate just how difficult that really is. Because to take something like zombies seriously, you have to become a legitimate authority on a make-believe subject. You have to be able to answer questions like these.
Well, I was just wondering how their coordination is with coming up over the rocks. I mean, especially if it's like a windy day, for example, how they'd be doing.
Are zombies susceptible to hypothermia?
That's a good question. What do you think?
I don't know. I would hope so.
Yeah. Do zombies have four-wheel drive? Because then that would make a difference.
Good, yeah.
As I fielded each one of these questions with a straight face and not a hint of irony, I started to wonder about the sanity of this project. I caught myself in the shower, daydreaming about the logistics of burying supplies on the Appalachian Trail. At work, I silently evaluated the worth of my colleagues. And at some point, I had to ask myself, am I becoming a prepper? Max Brooks.
I actually think a little bit of prepping is a very healthy thing. In fact, the federal government supports that. You know, organizations like FEMA and the CDC, they want you to prep. They want you to be ready for at least a couple weeks because, God forbid, there is a mega disaster. There simply isn't enough federal and state resources to help everybody on day one. But I think where it gets dangerous is this notion of people who are excited about society as a whole collapsing. You know, the people that you see on doomsday preppers, those are the carnival freaks. They want society to implode. And those people I would encourage to get a one-way ticket to Somalia and go live the dream.
It's not that I want society to implode, as Max puts it. But when survival is reduced to having a job and paying rent, going to the grocery store, when the stakes are in some way just as high, but the adrenaline is utterly low, the zombie apocalypse can sound downright thrilling. It has nothing to do with the living dead, really. It has everything to do with living life.
Let me ask you an odd question.
Yeah.
If there were like a zombie apocalypse, what do you think about hiding out on the top of Mount Washington?
Hell, I'd be there in a heartbeat, hole into some cave, right? Send them in, we'll put the boulders to them.
So you think it'd be a good spot?
Oh, yeah, I think you could hide out, but you probably wouldn't want that getting out. Next thing you know, the militia will be up here wanting to hide out in the mountains, right?
I think that's the worst part. Exactly. If we came up with a good idea.
As for whether Mount Washington would be a good place to ride out the zombie apocalypse, I think it's pretty clear that the real answer is no. Because as soon as we all agree it's a good idea, it becomes a really, really bad one. My hope is that in doing this investigation, I'll have convinced everybody to rule it out, and then at least the staffers, who are already up there, might have a passing chance at making it work, should the zombie apocalypse go down. As for me, I'm going to try and spend less time thinking about zombies and more time prepping for the occasional power outage or ice storm. Refresh my stock of candles and flashlights, pick up some batteries, maybe buy a few gallons of bottled water. Because how sad would it be to be ready for zombies, but get caught unprepared for another New England winter? For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
Well, Taylor may have blown Mount Washington's cover, but there are plenty of places in New Hampshire where you could hunker down for a zombie apocalypse. Where in the state would you head if the zombies were on the march? Remember, you'd have to have a fresh water supply, and it would have to be zombie-proof. Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. There's a lab in Minneapolis that has a Guinness World Record certified anechoic room. It's touted to be the world's quietest place. The room has been rigged to be 99.99% sound absorbent. It is so unnervingly quiet that the longest anyone has been able to stand being in the room is 45 minutes. People begin to hallucinate in the absence of external sound. They become disoriented, hearing only the beat of their heart and their breath entering and exiting their lungs. Unlike meditating in a quiet place, it is completely still. And people begin to feel a little mad. Silence is powerful. But as Joel Beckerman says, sound is also what anchors us in our world. Joel is an award-winning composer and producer for television and founder of Man-Made Music. That's a company specializing in sonic branding. And his new book is called Sonic Boom. Joel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So what happens to people inside of this anechoic chamber in Minneapolis?
Well, as you said so correctly in your intro, it is completely unnerving to be in an anechoic chamber because we are used to having this soundtrack around us all the time. Even if we think it's quiet, there's always something to listen to. So in that chamber, you do begin to hear the only thing there is in the room, which is yourself. And you start hearing your heartbeat, and you start hearing, if you hear a high-pitched whine, you actually hear the electromagnetic waves from your brain, and you're actually hearing these things, which is one of the reasons that you become so unnerved.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's not a pleasant experience from what I
understand.
I guess
it's not like, you know, does the Dalai Lama experience that? Do we know?
I don't know. I think he seems a little too calm for that, I would imagine. But I think the point really is that we cannot escape sound. It is around us every single moment of our entire lives, and we may not be aware of it.
And you mentioned in the book that once a person begins to listen for the sound in their lives, that they can't stop hearing it. You know, it's like, you know, thinking about buying a new car or an orange car. You see orange cars everywhere. When you create sonic experiences in stores or for the Super Bowl, which is one of the things that you've done, is the idea that you don't hear it, but you feel it? I mean, if a person notices the sound, does that mean something is not quite right?
Yes and no. It really depends on what it is, what experiences we're trying to provide to people, what kinds of ways we want to engage them, bring them into an experience. So often, sound that is overt, right in your face, can be very, very intrusive. And actually, that's the kind of thing that really repels people, wants them to walk away from experiences. But every once in a while, those kinds of sounds, which are very what we call foreground sounds, can be incredibly appealing. A song that you love in a, for instance, in a motion picture, or maybe there is somebody's voice that is front and center that's giving you some information that you might really love, or an actor who's being very evocative and emotional in terms of what they're speaking about. And then there's the opposite, where music and sound can be the score, the very sort of quiet, subtle background for an experience, and it just triggers your mood, sets you down a certain path. So, for instance, we created for AT&T in one of their retail stores, which is actually called an innovation store. So it's a bit different than a typical retail store. We created an experience for them. So when customers walk into the foyer right at the beginning, there is a very, very sort of quiet ambience. It's barely something that you can recognize, but it does change your mood. And then there are all these sort of whimsical sounds that come up every once in a while. There's a little, there's a moment where there is, you hear a little firework, and there's another where you hear something spinning or whirring in the distance. And then you hear a little metal ball kind of going down almost a xylophone kind of stairway, playing actually the AT&T notes in a very quiet, subtle way. And it just sets you, it sets your mood, and it sets you into this place, this mindset, where perhaps you're going to be open and you're going to be a little bit, you're going to slow down. Mm. Then we also talk about mid-ground sound, and those are the things that are in the middle. So please, if anybody is doing this during drive time, don't do this now, but you can do it when you get home, or if you happen to be home right now, you can close your eyes and listen to the sounds around you, and you'll hear things that are in the foreground, the midground, and the background, and you can begin to identify them and pick them apart and really decide for yourself which of those sounds help your experience and which detract.
Well, although they don't do it well necessarily, some restaurants and some retail spaces do carefully engineer how sound travels is used inside of their establishments. So there are places where sound, for example, keeps us in the store, you know, keeps us buying drinks. Is that allowed in? And there are others that, you know, they think, well, we want the table to turn over at X amount of time, so we'll make the sound a little louder. How does that work on us?
Well, there's a lot of research that shows that things like quick tempo music, a more upbeat music, does tend to move people through spaces quicker. That slower tempo music does tend to have you slow down. So, and there are many other metrics about that in terms of background music. But the main thing is that we're in an era now where people are incredibly savvy about these things. The sound in your advertising, the sound in your products, the sounds in the sponsorships and spaces, the sounds in the devices. If audiences feel that sound is put there to manipulate you, you turn them off, sometimes forever. Hmm. Now, the flip side is the companies that understand that really what people want is they want a relationship with these brands that they love. I know Apple certainly taught us that amongst many other brands. Apple has this wonderful startup sound, very sort of warm and rich and mellifluous type of sound. It wasn't always that way, by the way. We talk about that in the book, that the initial Mac sound was actually a very, very discordant, sort of mechanical, everything went wrong kind of sound. But now the Mac sounds are very warm and welcoming. And Apple does a wonderful job with sound in their spaces and also in their devices.
Well, so that is about sound engineering on the product end. But there's also the selling of those products. And I want you to just talk about jingles, because these are things that stick in people's heads for years. Let's listen to just a few of them that we find the stickiest.
Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Mayer wiener. That is what I'd be.
Oh, ice cold milk and an Oreo cookie. They forever.
Flop, flop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is.
I am stuck on Band-Aid brand, 'cause Band-Aid's stuck on me.
To be a pepper drink.
So those are jingles that were written for products, but now brands are more likely to use ready-made, well-known pop songs for their commercials. So we don't hear the custom brand jingles anymore. What happened to the jingles? Did they find them no longer effective?
Well, jingles really became no longer effective because, again, now we're in an age where we don't want to be sold. So if you think about the Oscar Mayer Wiener song or other jingles that we know from decades ago, it doesn't really necessarily remind you, make you think about the product today. It actually makes you think about simpler times when you were younger, when all of us were younger. And that's actually the warm feeling we get now is really more about our own personal history and associated with it. So you'll notice that there really are very, very rare occasions, and usually they're comedic ones now, where brands will create brand new jingles. However, and you're talking about the popular music examples, which is great. Popular music actually can be very powerful. But there are also a lot of brands that have gotten themselves into a fair amount of trouble that way. One that comes to mind off the top of my head is Royal Caribbean, which is a cruise ship company. And they loved this song, Lust for Life.
Iggy Pop?
You know, Iggy Pop, which, gee, it sounds so positive and up and energetic. But unfortunately, nobody bothered to really look at the lyrics and realize that the song was about a hooker and a heroin dealer. So that's an extreme example. But the public called out to Royal Caribbean, and this happens all the time now, where if brands are not smart enough to understand what the music means, and they really just try to sort of put it like a coat of paint on the outside of the barn of their brand, and they're not thinking about the meaning of it, it actually can have disastrous implications.
Joel Beckerman is an award-winning composer and producer for television and is founder of Man Made Music. It's a company specializing in sonic branding. His new book, written with Tyler Gray, is called Sonic Boom. Coming up, a Hollywood sound designer talks about his process for creating a demonic soundscape for the 2001 film From Hell, a murder mystery starring Johnny Depp. Listen for the sound of evil when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Now, before the break, we spoke with the author of Sonic Boom about the power of sound. Now we turn to an artist who uses that power to enhance moviegoers' experiences. In this piece, produced by Jonathan Mitchell, Hollywood sound designer Steve Boedeker talks about his process of developing a soundscape, in this case for the 2001 horror film From Hell, starring Johnny Depp as an opium-addicted detective hot on the trail of Jack the Ripper.
This first one is, I just called it Opium Den, and it's just one of the elements that we used in some of these nightmares in From Hell. And so the idea is, okay, how can we sort of simulate the sound effect of just like going into this crazed opium haze? And I felt like it was like water seemed to be an overall theme of a lot of it. It was like, okay, let's get the feeling of like going underwater through sound. So start this guy. It's got a watery quality to it, but you don't hear specific bubbles or anything like that. And
what is the sound? What is the actual sound?
Oh, God. I don't remember. This is one of those ones where it's this radically processed. I should have just written down what I was doing as I was doing it, but I just started going off. Played around a bunch. Oh, my God, that is so cool. Playing around and stuff and experimenting. Okay. You know, you start kind of goofing around with things, and you sort of got to see where it's going to take you. And it's like, oh, man, that was totally cool. As a sound designer, you can be a composer that has an unlimited palette of sounds to use in your compositions. And there's this sort of no man's land in between music and sound effects that you can do all kinds of things. So if you decide that at one point you need to have something be very intense and building and rhythmic, you can do that with anything. You can do that with a train building. You can do that with, like, low-end crashes that just build louder and louder and louder. Whatever you feel that you can sort of justify getting in there to help build that tension. Now, these are I called opium whooshes, which are just used for transitions to get in and out of other sounds. Here's another one that I did that talk about playing around. This is a recording of a bunch of little kids singing London Bridge is Falling Down that I slowed way down and then I processed and modulated. And definitely the idea wasn't to hear them singing London Bridges. I just thought it was kind of a funny little joke that it was made from little kids happily singing. But you put this in his dream and use little bits of it as sort of a texture. It's just strange and creepy. There's a couple scenes that take place in a morgue, and it's like, okay, how can we convey a feeling of just creepiness? It's not so much scary, just creepy. It's like, okay, we get this sort of low wind, and you just take some regular wind sounds and pitch them down and smooth them way out. And then stretch, stretch. Add to that like some drips and things like that, you get this pretty wet place. Another thing I added was just simple recordings of flies, which to me says dead bodies. And it's like, yikes. There seems to be sort of two different types of scary. There's the type of scary where you, as an audience member, know what's going to happen, and you're just waiting for it to happen. And then there's the type of scary where you don't know what's going to happen, but you know it's going to be bad. Like The Exorcist, when the mom's creeping around in the hall, and she hears the rats up in the attic. We have no idea what's going to happen, but it's just scary as hell. And I think a big part of that is, like, less is more. You know, you want to hear her light padding footsteps on the carpet, and you want to hear the rats in the attic, and you want to hear the flicker of her candle, and not much more. You're almost leaning into the screen to hear.
Nelson Lassie.
Jesus Christ, Carl, don't do that.
If you get to work on a scene that has, they kind of have their act together as far as what emotion they're trying to convey, it makes it really fun as a sound designer because you're already sort of where you want to be and you get a chance to sort of give people that extra nudge. Whereas the opposite is really difficult. If you don't feel like the scene is really working very well, but you know that they desperately want it to be scary or beautiful or funny, it's really hard. It's really hard. Because you really are working to support what you see. You know, sound is a really powerful thing, but it's the marriage of the sound and the visual that really does it.
That was sound designer Steve Boedeker talking about how he created a soundscape for the 2001 film From Hell. And that piece was produced by Jonathan Mitchell. Ophir Kutiel, also known as Kutiman, is a musician born and raised in Israel. In 2009, he released a series of songs crafted entirely from unrelated YouTube videos, the same way a DJ might pull samples from all kinds of different records. For example, you might start with a drum tutorial illustrating how to make a slow groove beat. Then add a little of Pachelbel's canon played on digital piano. then maybe some vocals. In this case, an original song done a cappella into the built-in microphone of a desktop computer.
Don't know how you look me in the eye, trying to apologize, you lied to me for the last.
So each of these videos on their own might see a few dozen to maybe a few thousand hits. But put those and more than a dozen other amateur YouTube videos together, and you get something that has the power to go much, much further.
I trusted you, gave you everything, but when it's all said and done, it doesn't mean a thing. Had my heart from the very start, but now that I'm looking back, I guess I wasn't smart.
That's My Vendetta, one of the tracks off Kudiman's new album of YouTube mashups Through You Too, which he released online for free earlier this month. And Kudiman joins us now from Israel. Hello there.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Very well. We just heard one possible sequence or setup of how we'd put together a song. How about you? Do you have a regular process? You know, do you start with the vocals? Do you start with the drums?
No, usually I just run across one video that inspires me to start a new track, and then I search the rest.
You must spend a lot of time looking at videos online.
Yes, I watch a lot of videos, and it's pretty inspiring and amazing to see how much talent there is out there.
Yeah, there really is something. I mean, the music stands on its own, but the videos, there's something really touching about watching them. All of these people playing music alone, you know, often in their bedrooms or garages, and unknowingly you bring them together in your videos. There's something a little lonely about it. How does the video footage play a role for you when you're making these mashups?
Yeah, I take in consideration also the video. You know, sometimes I find something that musically fits, but the video doesn't work. And sometimes the other way around, like the music not exactly fits, but the video is amazing. So I have to work a lot to put it together. And I think there's something that people relate to the simplicity in the videos, you know, that it's real without all the makeup and flashes and the realness in it.
The spotlight in the videos really seems to be on the people, the artists that you sample. Now, you, however, are kind of a mysterious dude. Do you prefer to keep to the shadows?
Yes. I don't like the spotlight, really. And I just like to create music, you know, sometimes in this way from YouTube.
But this isn't even your main gig. I mean, you are a DJ that gets hired, you know, flies around the world to do big, big parties. What do? You wear dark glasses and a hat or something like that?
No. My main thing is producing, and most of my time I spend in a studio producing other artists or my own music. And I have my band that we go around a little bit, but nothing like with glasses and big hats.
Well, now you've made a big point of linking to all the videos you use in Through You and Through You Too, this second record. And you can even do a sort of split screen so people can see the simultaneous musicians in their separate little spaces coming together. Is it important to you that all the artists you use get credit?
Yeah, it's very important. I think it's at the end of the day, they are playing. I'm, you know, just putting it together. And I think it also gives people better view of how I build this, and they can go and see where the piano comes from and where the vocals comes from. And I think it's really exciting to see.
And to hear as well. So let's hear another track from the new album. This is Give It Up. This is from Kudiman's second album of video mashups, Through You Too. About how many separate videos, if you remember, did you use to create this song, Give It Up, that we're listening to?
I think this one is around 23 different musicians.
Wow. So you loop little bits from individual ones and maybe bump up the sound in some and others?
Yes, exactly. I take like specific parts from each video and put them all together.
How long does it take to do that? 23 different videos?
It took the entire album with six tracks in it, like three months, something like that.
Wow. Are there particular instruments that are harder to find videos that kind of match up?
No, but sometimes it's really hard to find a vocalist, you know, to fit the scale and the tempo. And some scales are more difficult than others, but it's really like fishing, you know, just sit there and sometimes it comes fast, sometimes it takes longer.
Well, I've noticed that a lot of the vocalists you use are women. Is that an artistic choice or is there just a better selection of female singers on YouTube?
Actually, on this project, I wanted to do all ballads with the female vocalists. Maybe next time I'll do the same thing with male.
Have you ever met any of the people that you featured in your videos?
I actually met one of the singers from the first two you, Leslie, from the song called, can't remember the song, but yeah, it was really touching and exciting to actually meet the real person behind the video, and it was amazing.
Well, she must have been happy too. Now, you know, some of your videos been seen more than a million times.
Yes, she was very happy, and most of the comments I get from the musicians, they're really happy to find about it, and they're really excited about it, and some of them also get a lot of attention. I'm very happy about it.
Has anybody ever said to you, please don't use my video, I don't like it, what you've done?
No, not really. I had one misunderstanding with one musician. She thought that I'm selling it and making a lot of money and it's commercial. But after I talked to her, she understood, and now she support the project and she loves it.
Well, let's listen to another track. This is No One in This World. Videos you see on YouTube of amateur musicians playing by themselves, sometimes doing instructionals. Well, our guest Kudiman is a musician and a video mashup artist, and he turns those into songs. His new album of online videos is called Through You Too. I'm thinking about what you said about the musician who wanted to know if you were making money off of her work. Now, some of these have been viewed on YouTube more than 1.5 million times. If those were album sales, that would be a platinum record. Do you have any interest in trying to make this project commercial?
Actually, not at all. It started as just something I do on my free time, and it is still something I do on my free time, and I just love doing it. And no, actually, not really looking for making money out of this.
I wonder if people are going to start pitching you, you know, sending stuff to Kudiman and saying, look, I did an amateur video. It's really good. What do you think? Could you use me?
I'm actually getting quite a lot of emails and people sending me their, you know, look, this is my daughter playing drums and this is my brother. And I love it, you know, and some of them I put aside, and maybe in the future projects I'll use them.
Wow, did you ever think of yourself, Kudiman, as a star maker? You're giving people a bump.
I'm doing my best, you know. I don't know if a star maker, but I'm trying to show how much talent there is on YouTube, unused talent.
Well, Kudiman, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your talent with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Ophir Kutiel, he's also known as Kutiman, and you can check out his new album of YouTube mashups. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Definitely worth seeing. Thanks so much for listening today. There's much more to hear at wordofmouthradio.org if you missed any part of the show. You can also catch up by subscribing to the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth on iTunes. And the link is also at wordofmouthradio.org. And we invite you to tell your friends from all over. They can tune into Word of Mouth whether they live in Berlin, New Hampshire, or Berlin, Germany. I'm Virginia Prescott. You can always find more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. This is how